Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. President Trump wants to put up walls, but will they work?
When we talk about walls, everybody always says to me, don't forget outer. O-U-T-A. People always find their way over, under, through, or around walls. You can't stop it.
Coming up, Michael Deere explains why a second wall along the US-Mexican border appeals to few, except perhaps drug cartels and the border industrial complex. Before we get to that, though, big news in the small town of Santa Monica.
This morning, the Santa Monica City Council reached a historic agreement with the federal government to close Santa Monica Airport forever on December 31st, 2028.
That was Santa Monica Mayor Ted Winter at a press conference at Santa Monica City Hall this past Saturday. Now, the city has been fighting the Federal Aviation Administration for years. So what prompted this agreement? And what will happen to the more than 200 acres of land? And what does it all have to do with a little charter company called JetSuite X? First, we spoke to Rick Cole, Santa Monica City Manager.
It's a historic change of attitude on the part of the Federal Aviation Administration. I think they recognized that we were not going to quit, that we were going to chase them through every court of the land, and that ultimately we would prevail. And so we worked out what is, I think, as all compromises are, there's some good and some bad for both sides. But we won on the issue of closing the airport and having certainty that we can close the airport to turn it into a park. And we have immediate relief for the residents of Santa Monica and Los Angeles by shortening the runway.
Is the bad on the Santa Monica side that there's still a 10-year wait?
That's the tough part, is that we would like to close the airport immediately, but no airport has been closed without FAA approval in history before now. So it's not our favorite compromise, and the council was split 4-3 on this. For thinking that with the Trump administration beginning, this was the time to take what we could achieve in certainty and in immediate relief.
You were present at the negotiations. To the extent you can speak for the FAA, what do you think swung it for them?
I don't think they've ever had to deal with a community as united and as sophisticated and as tenacious and determined as the city of Santa Monica.
Santa Monica, sophisticated city, very affluent city. Some of those affluent folks are recreational flyers. They use the private jets that go out of Santa Monica Airport. What happens to those operations and how do you satisfy that community?
There's going to be fierce opposition to this consent decree from both sides. We live in a time when people debate fiercely, but this will be enforceable in a court of law. And it gives the citizens of Santa Monica certainty that they control the land they own.
It came to a head recently. A company called JetSuite X, as I understand it, was planning to start charter flights next week on a
That's correct.
Of Uber model.
That's correct.
It was going to be something like $25 a seat for you or I to go and get on a private jet. Did news of that decision sort of speed up your decision making?
This was one of the real imminent threats that influenced our thinking in entering into the consent decree. The Uber and Lyft model that's applying to automobiles is now being applied to the air, and it's becoming very inexpensive for people to be able to use jets in small airports. And we've been seeing a real increase in jet traffic and the threat of much more very soon. So it's to ward off that threat. It was important for us to shorten this runway.
That was City Manager Rick Cole. He was present at the negotiations that took place in Chicago. Now, airport supporters and the FAA have long argued that Santa Monica's airport is a crucial air transportation artery in the region, serving emergency relief needs as well as the business and entertainment community. And residents in South Santa Monica have long lived with little Cessnas and biplanes and propeller planes buzzing over their heads. And then what really enraged locals was the rise of larger class C and D jets taking off and landing at the airport on a runway not long enough to safely operate those jets. The city says the FAA created a waiver of their own rules to allow this to happen. by doing that, did the FAA push Santa Monicans too far? Joe Lawrence is interim city attorney, and he headed up the negotiations with the FAA.
The city, over time, certainly tried to change the way the airport operated. And so by failing to achieve reasonable resolution of disputes earlier, you get to hardened positions, and you get to this compromise, which probably many in the FAA don't agree with, but they're going along with.
Santa Monica's an affluent and powerful city relative to its size, but still, it's little. The FAA is huge. Do you feel this was a David versus Goliath victory?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's not only David versus Goliath, it's anybody versus Goliath. No other community has achieved this. This is different from, you know, Chicago bulldozing an otherwise unused airfield, or a smaller community being given permission to close an airport that has almost no use. But this is a fully functional airport that the FAA has invested a lot of energy into trying to convince not only Santa Monica, but everybody, that it was vital to the national airspace.
That was Joe Lawrence, interim city attorney for the city of Santa Monica. Now, celebration was in the air Saturday at Santa Monica City Hall. But with one huge battle won, do the smaller battles now commence? As Mayor Ted Winter pointed out,
we will be able to regain local control over 227 acres of land within the Santa Monica borders. I wouldn't begin to know how to estimate what that's worth. $2 billion, $3 billion. And that is a windfall for all the residents of the city.
A windfall for the city that will be used exactly how? Well, the majority of Santa Monica voters want to see it turned into a park. This they made clear at the ballot box in 2014 when they passed Measure LC, mandating that if the airport were to close, it had to be used for open space, recreation and or cultural uses, unless voters approved otherwise. But how exactly will such a park be paid for? And is it the best use of a large piece of valuable land in a city with a shortage of housing? And what happens to Barker Hangar, the Museum of Flying, Santa Monica College art classrooms, and the other cultural amenities that are there right now? Back to Mayor Ted Winterer.
I really suspect that people in Santa Monica would never vote to approve a large residential development or any of the other things, or certainly not an office park. Now, that said, as the aviation businesses leave, whether they do so in the short term or they do so when the airport closes, that frees up a lot of existing space there, the hangars and other buildings that the creative businesses, that sort of office space is very much in demand. We just leased actually a fair amount of square footage to Snapchat at the airport, and they would like to have more space there. Our thinking is when we're able to lease to those higher paying tech businesses the existing space without building another single square foot, we could use that revenue to underwrite the cost of the new park. Or we might have to go to the financial markets to issuing a bond or something else for part of the capital costs. But certainly the revenues and the rents pay for the operation of the park, I would imagine, three times over.
That was Santa Monica Mayor Ted Winterer. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Not everybody is thrilled to see the airport close down, but at the press conference Saturday, we met folks wearing green T-shirts emblazoned with the words Airport to Park.
I'm Frank Gruber, and I've been a longtime activist to turn the airport into a park. I'm on the board of the Santa Monica Airport to Park Foundation. And it's really the last great chance to have a great park on the west side of LA. This property, 170 to 200 acres, could never be assembled today, no matter how much money you had. And we only have it because of the foresight of Santa Monicans back in the 1920s who bought the land.
They bought the land.
They bought the land with a parks bond. Now, at the time, parks included nice little things like airplanes.
Nice little biplanes.
Yeah, nice little biplanes.
Little biplanes.
They didn't realize that Donald Douglas was going to turn it into one of the biggest factories in the world, Arsenal of Democracy and all of that kind of thing. So they basically used a parks bond to buy land that turned into an industrial site. And we now, the city of Santa Monica, will be turning an industrial site into a park, something that's been going on all over the world.
And we should say that Mark Rios, the firm of Mark Rios,
yes,
is designing it.
He hasn't been hired to the Great Park, but he has been hired to do the first expansion. And those 12 acres are now in process of being designed by Mark to be fully integrated as a park with fields and picnic areas and that kind of thing. But in the meantime, the city is going to do something incredibly innovative, which is to open up the asphalt to people to use as a park, like in Tempelhof in Berlin, which is where they've taken giant amounts of asphalt, turned into a park that people love for everything from roller skating to skateboarding to cycling to just walking around.
There is a historical irony here, though, because you just said it was bonded as a park back in the 20s, and then Donald Douglas came along, turned it into this massive engine of dirty industry, but also generated around it a blue-collar working community. Blue-collar working communities don't have a home in Santa Monica anymore, and it'll be even less so as the value of property goes up even more
because
of the park.
Well, first of all, Donald Douglas is probably the most important person in the history of Santa Monica. We get that. We believe the park will show the history of that. But in terms of the blue-collar neighborhood that was there, the answer to the housing issues on the west side of L.A. are not solved by turning brownfields like this that are publicly owned and available for parks into housing. Because if you're going to increase the housing density to build workforce housing, you need park space. You cannot expect to have the kind of urban densities, the elegant density that our former mayor in L.A. talked about, without having the amenities like parks that people need and deserve.
I think there's another piece of that. And my name is Sean Landris. I also chair the Social Services Commission for the City of Santa Monica. I live up the street from the airport. And my kids and my wife and I were here for this press conference because thinking about the loss of jet noise that has been increasing over the last 18 months, it's extraordinary. And as someone who's lived here as long as I have, I feel tremendous satisfaction in this victory and look forward to the city now having the time and the energy to turn its attention to the many, many, many other challenges and opportunities before us.
This is Michael Brodsky. I'm a board member of Santa Monica Airport to Park Foundation. With the issues that we're confronted with environmentally, this allows us to reduce our carbon footprint for the first time, reduce particulates, the heat effects on the existing airport, allow us to possibly retain 60 million gallons of H2O water runoff that runs off the runway every year.
But those environmental costs will be displaced somewhere else. They're not disappearing. Other airports will bear those costs.
Well, Meigs Field in Chicago, what they found out from the General Accounting Office is that 30% of the flights that went into that airport ceased to fly after that airport was closed. So much of the fact that this is, just like you provide parking and it brings in more traffic, this will allow at least a certain amount of reduction. There will be some dispersal, but it will also allow a whole myriad of environmental positives that are going to come out of this, not just about air traffic alone.
You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton, and we're talking about a deal reached to close the nearly century-old Santa Monica Airport. So how about JetSuite X? That is the charter company that seems to have precipitated the negotiations with its plan for an Uber-style affordable small jet service. The company currently flies in and out of Burbank, Concord, San Jose, Las Vegas, and Bozeman, Montana, and it was about to launch in Santa Monica next week. Now, will it simply curtail this business or take it elsewhere? Alex Wilcox is CEO of JetSuite X, and he criticised what he calls a backroom deal, even though he knows that many Santa Monicans have wanted this airport closed for years.
The city of Santa Monica could vote to close the interstate freeway, the I-10 freeway, but that wouldn't make it happen. Some things are federal domain and some things are local domain, and the airspace and the highways are one of the things that are federal. So it was shocking and very unprecedented for the federal government to give back land to locality and to agree to allow a locality to close its airport. It's actually unprecedented in FAA history.
Now, have you spoken to the folks at the FAA and asked why they made this decision?
Yeah, and the answer we're getting right now is that this decision was made by people who were on their way out, not by the people that are taking over the FAA now, and kind of a parting shot from the previous administration. That probably makes it subject to review by the new administration. And so I think it makes it vulnerable. And then also not including user groups, you know, I think also makes it vulnerable as well. So I don't think the last has been heard about this.
But are you sensitive, though, to the concerns of Santa Monica residents who really didn't like having this airport right in their midst?
No, I think it's very cynical, actually. You know, the complaints about the airport by the minority, the small number of people who are actually vehemently against the airport, are about noise, safety, and pollution. And, you know, with respect to noise, the jets that we fly, by the way, are much quieter than small propeller airplanes, which don't climb as fast and tend to hang around the area. And then in terms of safety, you know, there's never been a civilian on the ground killed in the history of the airport in the last 100 years. And then and as far as pollution, you know, it's extremely cynical because, I mean, there are people on my Facebook page that are posting about how much they hate airplane noise. You go to their Facebook page and there's pictures of them in Honolulu, pictures of them in Paris, pictures of them in South America. These clearly are people that use airplanes routinely and regularly, but they just choose to export, you know, whatever pollution, and by the way, it's very, very little, whatever pollution comes out of airplanes, they would rather have it go over to the residents of Inglewood than the residents of Santa Monica. So, and what they're actually all looking for is just an increase in their local property values. If you own a house that's next to the Santa Monica Airport and the Santa Monica Airport closes, you probably just doubled or trebled the value of your house. And that's what this is really about.
So even though the city's saying the airport's going to close, are you anticipating continuing your business there?
Well, look, we've sold over 1,000 tickets. We haven't even started the service yet. You know, it's supposed to start a week from today, in fact. And so there's huge demand in that market, and we think that that it's ripe for service in some size aircraft. So we really wanted to do it in the 30-passenger airplanes we've got. And given the advanced sales that we saw, that were dramatically high, and in fact, higher than any other market we've ever launched in our history, you know, that tells us that there's a lot of people in Santa Monica that want to use the airport. We sold over 1,000 tickets. Over half of those tickets were sold to Santa Monica residents, by the way. I mean, we definitely had a lot of interest from Snapchat, from Google, from Netflix and other local companies, you know, in using the service out of Santa Monica. And they're all going to be bitterly disappointed that it won't be available.
Because Snapchat is going to locate right at the airport. They've taken
literally space
in the
same building from which we'd be operating, yes.
But to all those people who've already bought their tickets, what are you telling them now?
We'll tell them, here's your full refund. And if you... you know, if you wanted to have this service, then please complain to the city leaders of Santa Monica. The city also chose to just put their bullet points out, but not actually publish the entire consent decree. So we don't even know what our rights are or what the decree says, you know, exactly. And depending on what it says, you know, we'll make a determination whether or not to fight it. The city, as legislatures often do, or government bodies often do, make it very unintended consequences from this agreement, you know, by shortening the runway. We won't be able to operate our 30-passenger airplane anymore. But we can go out and get some 15-passenger airplanes, which will have to operate twice as frequently, you know, to serve the same number of people. So this agreement might actually, you know, dramatically increase the use of that airport versus decrease it.
You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Coming up next, President Trump has shown how eager he is to make good on promises to keep certain people out. More after this break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Frances Anderton. President Trump vowed throughout his campaign to build a beautiful wall along the 2,000-plus-mile U.S.-Mexican border, and he'd make Mexico pay for it. Well, Mexico's saying no way, and Trump's own party is confused. Here's Senator John McCain talking to reporters at the GOP retreat.
When you say, quote, build a wall, what does that exactly mean? It means to me drones, technology, surveillance, all that. If you're talking about just building a wall, history shows that you can tunnel under them, you can breach them, and you can climb over them.
But what exactly is the point of the wall, and would it even work? Michael Deere is a professor emeritus of city and regional planning at UC Berkeley. He spent several years traveling along both sides of the U.S.-Mexican border, and he wound up writing a book entitled Why Walls Don't Work.
walls generally don't work in the long run. Globally and historically, they've solved problems for a short while. For example, they've created a partition between warring parties to let the cooling off period occur. But generally speaking, longer term peace is not served by simply putting up a partition or a barrier between two disputing communities. And sooner or later, of course, they all come down. The Great Wall of China is now basically a resort, a tourist destination. The Berlin Wall is down, and who knows what happens in other places in the world. Right now, wall building is very, very much in fashion, and I think it's a reflection of the fact that we are not very good at managing ourselves these days.
And you have made a trek by car and on foot along the entirety of the Mexico-American Wall. What did you find?
Well, it's very important to make clear that we all already have a wall on the land portion of our southern boundary. That was the effect, or the outcome, really, of the post 9/11 scares in this country. And we built a wall then. We built 650 miles of fencing and walls along the land boundary. The land boundary occupies about one third of the total 2,000 miles of the boundary. And the Rio Grande River occupies the other two thirds. And there's not much wall building there. So what we are now discussing is a second wall. And when I come into these kind of circumstances, I always ask myself, well, what did we learn and what did we gain from the first wall? Very early on, around 2006, the Department of Homeland Security started to build a wall. It continued very rapidly and completed those 650 miles in about the next 5-6 years. It didn't take long before the Department of Homeland Security confessed very early on in the building that the wall was not meant to stop people, but the wall was simply meant to slow them down. And they could be picked up by more conventional means like border patrol officers and so on. It's very difficult to say how effective walls are, but the best indicator that we have over this last 10-year period is that the number of undocumented people in this country has diminished from 12.4 million to 11.1 million. I think that the most important reasons in those reductions have to do with increasing the number of Border Patrol officers, rapidly increasing the number of deportations to the highest record level ever, over 400,000 a year. We've also been in a circumstance where the U.S. economy has been in a slump and therefore less attractive to migrants coming to the country, at the same time as Mexico has been in a rather strong economic position. What no one can say categorically is that the wall or any other single factor has contributed most to the declines. My own sense is that the wall has had only a marginal effect.
So you're distinguishing the physical wall from Border Patrol.
Sort of, yes, like that. But you're absolutely correct in making the emphasis on the variety of infrastructure. If you took pictures, as I have done, along the wall, you'll see that the wall itself is obviously a strong presence. But there are also surveillance towers, stadium lighting, balloons.
Balloons? What are the balloons for?
I don't mean Christmas balloons. I mean balloons which have surveillance apparatuses. They're high in the sky. They're blimps kind of thing. And drones. There are staging areas for all the vehicles. There are Border Patrol operating centers. There's all-terrain vehicles. There's interior checkpoints. There's vehicle barriers. There's a whole panoply of structures which you could say together constitute the national security defense apparatus. And the wall is only one piece of them.
But to the extent you understand what President Trump is referring to by a wall, what is it? Is it physical? Is it virtual?
Some of the programs that are being advanced right now in those two executive orders basically are more focused on local policing, immigration raids internally, and other kind of internal control factors. But of course, everybody's talking about the wall because that's what he's been talking about incessantly for the past several months. Nobody really expects poured concrete to be used. The closest thing that people are talking about right now is a series of concrete slabs which are held up by steel posts or pillars.
Are there vested financial interests on both sides of the wall that sort of stand to benefit from maintaining and even expanding on this wall?
That's a really interesting and straightforward question. On the United States side, it less so on the Mexican side. On the Mexican side, just briefly, the people who stand most to gain from more fortifications along the wall are the drug cartels. The drug cartels have been quite happy to have the barriers built because they know where they can go in and where they can leave. They know how to control those entry and exit ports of entry, as they are called. On our side, in the United States, there's something which I've called the border industrial complex, which includes security industries, which includes Boeing and other contractors who actually build the fences. A few years ago, when immigration reform was being negotiated, I think it was in 2008, the $40 billion that were being set aside for programs there were identified as a treasure trove for the contractors and interests in the border security industries. Of course, they stand to gain an enormous amount from the expenditures which are now maybe going to be put in place by the new Trump administration. People who are selling and building walls are going to make a lot of money.
And you've discovered in your journey along the wall, one, you've discovered these communities that exist at the border despite the presence of the wall. And you've also discovered these really odd anomalies as it butts up against geographic obstructions, or it butts up against obstructions like privately owned land in states like Texas.
Mm-hmm. Some of the terrain is just simply too precipitous and too dangerous, impossible to build on. Some of these are sheer vertical rock cliffs. Other parts of the terrain are in or are over water, and some parts are on sand dunes, which are inherently unstable. And so we've already reached the limit of wall building. The other thing to remember in Texas especially is that over 95% of the land is in private hands, and people don't like to have their private property messed with. So the first wall on the small sections which were built in Texas at that time were pretty much universally subject to lawsuits by landowners who didn't want the federal government coming in and building on their lands.
That's going to be entertaining to watch, the private landowners of Texas going up against Donald Trump. That will be something to watch, that particular...
It's a paradox which has caught my attention.
Yes. For every wall that gets built, there's a tunnel that gets dug. So I presume that if anything moves forward with this wall building, we'll see the countermeasure being very quickly dreamed up as well.
When we talk about walls, this is just a quick aside. Everybody always says to me, don't forget outer, O-U-T-A. People always find their way over, under, through or around walls. You can't stop it.
That was Michael Deer. He's Professor Emeritus of City and Regional Planning at UC Berkeley. He's author of a book called Why Walls Don't Work, Repairing the US-Mexico Divide. He's also a contributor to the forthcoming book, Border Wall as Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton, and that's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. JC Swatek mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.